Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. One of the more interesting meetings of the Parliament of the World's Religion has been the interaction between those concerned with building world peace, a dialogue that's been going on for some years which has ever more urgency associated with it. One of those who's an ambassador in both directions is Rabbi Michael Melchior, who joins us now on Sunday night. Rabbi Michael Melchior, welcome to Sunday Night.
Thank you very much.
You have a deep connection to Israel. You have been an assistant foreign minister. You have worked tirelessly in the cause of sort of international cooperation and peace building for Israel. Yet you also have other European connections. You were born in Denmark and you are chief rabbi of Norway. Explain this conundrum to us.
Well, it's much more simple than it sounds. I was born in Denmark. My family lived 350 years in Denmark for the last seven generations as rabbis and chief rabbis of the Danish Jewish community. I have a lot of good roots in Denmark. For example, my great belief in fairy tales comes from my family's very strong involvement with Hans Christian Andersen, who I think the Australians probably also have heard about, who was a fairy tale, and he stayed when he came as a poor student to Copenhagen. He stayed for several years with my family at that time. Also, later on in the Danish Jewish history, I have connections with the rescue, the famous rescue of the Danish Jews during the Holocaust, which was really a story which is so unique on the background of what went on everywhere else in Europe, but actually the Danish people as a collective, very bold contribution, saved nearly all the Jews of Denmark, amongst them my parents and grandparents, which is part of the reason why I'm alive. So that is the Danish connection. Norwegian connection is that because the job as chief rabbi of Denmark was occupied by my father, I had to find places in the vicinity, and the closest I could get was to Norway. So already for many, many years, I've been chief rabbi of Norway. At the same time, I, after some years, moved to Israel and commuted between Jerusalem and Oslo and also to many other places. And eventually I also got somehow dragged into Israeli politics, and for many years was a cabinet minister and member of Knesset. And at the same time I kept the title as chief rabbi of Norway. It's very good to have fallback positions in politics, also in Israel. And so the connection is very clear and good connection. I don't get any salary for this. I'm a rabbi for a big community in Jerusalem. And actually in the recent years, I have even my son as the active resident rabbi in Norway, so that we can continue a family tradition.
It's great to have deep cultural connections, and you appreciate your Scandinavian as well as the connections in Israel. In Israel, you've chosen to get active very much in the role of peace building. At the moment, the politics are difficult. You've had a period of retreat on both sides. The Netanyahu government is very solid in its stand, particularly around Jerusalem and the territories. The Americans are now re-looking at the situation. For somebody who's been involved in this process, and the Oslo process, of course, linked back to Scandinavia, over so many years, what's your disposition at the moment? Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the immediate situation facing Israel politically?
Well, first of all, as you mentioned, the Oslo process was not a strange process for me, as I was very involved with all parts of this process, both the Israeli and the Palestinian and the Norwegian side, working also as advisor in human rights issues to the Norwegian foreign minister at that time. But the situation now is very difficult. There's one good story about this, and that is that the vast majority of both Israeli and Palestinians want peace and want more or less the same peace, which is not true when the Oslo Accords were signed 16 years ago. The bad news is that nobody believes it's possible. The total lack of belief this is part of the disappointment. When you go down a blind alley again and again and again and don't succeed, then it's much easier for the skeptics to have their voice heard. And what has happened is that people have lost belief, lost confidence. And that's a bad thing, and we can't afford this to happen again and again. So this is also another reason why it would be good to succeed in a process. When it comes to being optimist or pessimist, I don't think it's so relevant. First of all, of nature, I'm optimistic. If you look at Jewish history and where Jews have been just 100, 120 years ago, and look where we are today, we have reason to be grateful and to be optimistic. And I learned from my father already many years ago that to be Jewish is to be optimistic. Otherwise, we would not have gone through Jewish history. Also, he taught me that if you can't see the light in the end of the tunnel, it's not because the light is not there. It's because the tunnel is not straightforward. Sometimes you have to go around corners, and we human beings don't have the ability of looking around the corners. So I think that what we have to do, and what we're not sufficiently doing, I'm talking also on the highest political level. I met in my time in the government as a deputy foreign minister, I met with practically all of the foreign ministers and many of the prime ministers of Europe and the rest of the world. And they all had some kind of roadmap. This was at the time of the Second Intifada. And they had a roadmap, and I said, fine, but teach us how to get to the first station in this roadmap. This is our real problem. And I think that we have to be much more creative and look at where were the mistakes we did during this process, which has gone on not only 60 years, but you can say more than 40 years. Where were the mistakes so that we don't repeat the mistakes and we can do a better job, because both peoples need it. Listen, we've come a long way in recognizing that we're living between this tiny area, especially I see how tiny it is when I compare it to what goes on in Australia. Between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, we have this tiny area with about 11.5 million people living there. A little more than half of them are Jewish, and a little less than a half are Palestinian Arabs. And we're going to be there. We have nowhere else to go. We have no intention to go anywhere else. And the same is true for the Palestinians. So we might as well work it out together. We can't win a war, because you can't win wars like this anymore. And also the terror will not chase us away. We're not going to go anywhere away. So we're there. We're stuck with each other. We have to breathe each other's air. We have to drink each other's polluted water. So why not cooperate? Why not find a political solution, especially as we know what that solution is? And I think that the message also from this conference, and I'm becoming more and more confident that this is at least part of the key, is that we need to establish some kind of religious framework which can legitimize the peace process. You see, the part of the problem of the peace process has been that it's been a very secularized process. Even some of the people who have been the actors in the field of peacemaking have been people who see the peace process as a kind of internal cheap secularization of the both societies. And what has happened then is that because they don't want to hear about religion, because only mischief can come out of religion. By the way, I don't blame people who say that mischief comes out of religion, because if you look around the world today, you will see that there is a lot of mischief coming out of religion. But what I just, the point I want to make is that by excluding religion from peacemaking, by ignoring it, it doesn't go away, it blows up in your faces. And the more extreme and totalitarian forces are the ones which then can take over.
It's linked to the point you made about pessimism. With pessimism, you get a hollowing out of the centre, and people need security, so they move to the sides, so they move to the extremes. So there's a tendency for the extremes to say, we have the truth here.
Yes,
you lose confidence in the centre, we'll go to the sides.
Yes, and we have in all religions a certain measure of totalitarianism. Right? Not only that we have and sitting on the truth, but we have the whole truth, and nobody else has any truth. So therefore, we can easily dismiss totally the other side and the aspirations of the other side. Now, I don't say that the Palestinians have to accept Zionism in order to for there to be peace. I don't have any problem with that. The Palestinians believe that the whole of the territory is theirs. I also have no problems with Jews believing that Judea and Samaria, for sure, an old part of what was the ancient Jewish homeland, with the many historic places and places where Jews have lived up to modern times, that we look at Hebron and Bethlehem and Nablus and so on as part of the Jewish homeland. I don't think we need to give up that that dream. But we have to recognize that there is another people living here. And if we want to have safety and if we want to build a future for our homes and have at least some of our dreams fulfilled, then also the other side needs to have safety and needs to build a future. And therefore, without giving up dreams and aspirations, recognizing that there is another people living there and that we need to work it out together, is something which is really celebration of life, which is the heart of all religion.
You seem to be implying politically at least a one-state solution rather than a two-state.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about two states, the state of Palestine and the state of Israel, living in peace together. I don't think a one-state solution is possible. I think that the Jewish people has a right to have a state with much smaller borders than we have today, which are not that broad in any case. I think we have a right to have a state as long as it's a state which is built on democratic principles and gives full rights also to its Arab-Palestinian minority, both individual rights and collective rights in the state of Israel. I think that we have a right. We have 23 Muslim states, or Arab states, sorry. We have 57 Muslim states. And we can have one tiny Jewish state also where we can develop also as a majority something which Jews haven't been able to do for thousands of years, to develop also our own self-determination, our own decision-making. At the same time, as I believe, also because this territory is so small that we will have to work it out with a Palestinian state, we will have to find eventually some kind of federation or some kind of way of cooperation, because we can't make a real sharp division between these two countries.
You're on Sunday Night with John Cleary. My guest is Rabbi Michael Melchior. Michael is a Danish former member of the Israeli Knesset, who's currently the chief rabbi of Norway, and whose family over the years played host to this man, as recalled by one Danny Kaye.
I'm Hans Christian Andersen, Andersen, that's who.
Danny Kaye, I'm Hans Christian Andersen. Danny Kaye there with a tribute to a man who was once a guest in the family home of our guest, Michael Melchior. Michael Melchior, let's talk for a moment about religion. I heard you at one stage in this conference say that it's quite comfortable to be here in Australia because you could talk with friends and everybody was happy. But you're interested in the day you could sit down and talk with Hamas. How close are we to those sorts of discussions?
We're much closer than anybody thinks. The problem often in these conferences, besides from the very positive networking and that you can come out in a way very optimistic, is that these are the good guys who come to these conferences. Those are the ones who want to make peace and who are willing to share and to interpret also scriptures in a context of relevance for building a future today. While the more totalitarian elements would not dream of coming here to Melbourne and talking about these terrible things. And that's where the real problem is. And this is a problem in a lot of the peacemaking in the world today. In the Oslo process, we saw it very, very clearly. And what happened was that many countries around the world, of goodwill, I don't want to be cynical about it, but they invited the very left of Israeli politics with the very left of Palestinian politics to all kinds of lovely meeting places in a castle in the Alps of Switzerland, and we would sit together there with beautiful view and beautiful food for a week, and we would always make some peace deal, and the Swiss government or any other government would be very pleased because now they'd made peace. And then we would go back home and we would kill each other, because it really had no relevance, because you don't make peace by only speaking to the converted, also in a people-to-people effort. You need to deal where the problem is. And the problem is that the vast majority of the peoples of the Middle East look towards religion as their major source of identity and of justification, legitimization. And therefore, if you cannot involve a major part of society in any kind of the process, then you can make all the deals in Oslo or in Washington or in Tokyo or wherever we've been during these years, but they won't affect the situation on the ground. The good news is that already for many years, this has been like, you know, the old Cato who always said the same thing again and again and again. I've been going on for this quite a long time. And I would say the important recognition I've come to see is that on both sides, people who otherwise are very far away from a language of peace, a rhetoric of peace, when they see that the other side is willing to accept a peace, also a religious peace, if we, for example, in Israel, could be convinced that not only we cut a deal with an Abu Mazen, but that we can cut a deal with Islam. Islam will accept us, even if we have much narrower borders, but that Islam will accept a tiny Jewish state in this area, this would be a real breakthrough in the attitude and the fears, and legitimate fears, which the Israelis have. And what I've come to see is that there are equivalent fears on the other side. It's not symmetrical, but there are equivalent fears. And I've come to see that there are central Islamic leaders, some of them also the spiritual leaders of the Hamas, who, if this is done the right way, will be willing to risk a lot in order to create a peace, not because they've become Zionists, but because they believe it's good for their people.
Rabbi Michael, let me ask you, as a teacher, where do you sit in the tradition? What for you is Judaism?
Well, I was born into the Jewish tradition. I grew up with this. I studied this. I don't know anything else. That's why I never studied in university. I don't know anything else. That's what I know what to do. I'm an Orthodox Jew. I have an Orthodox ordination to Judaism at the same time as I very much talk to Jews of other beliefs, and I very much talk to people of other beliefs. But I work and function as a rabbi, as a religious judge inside the orthodoxy of Judaism.
Religions at their heart provide people with validation. They are deeply central. The religions of the book share a common story, but it's interpreted in radically different ways. Is there the beginning of shared understandings of what the book is saying?
No, I don't think so, because I think that we have different books. Actually, the truth is that the whole concept of Jewish people is the people of the book is an Islamic concept. Most people don't know that. But listen, we have different stories, okay? Many of the stories of the Torah and Jewish tradition and Midrash are stories which are later found very equal in Islam. And we both have to believe in our narrative. I would not want that kind of theological dialogue, who is right and whose story, or to create like one religion together. That's not the point. On the opposite, I think that people who are confident in their own culture, their own tradition, their own identity, who know where they belong, they can also appreciate that a neighbor also has a culture and identity and knows where they belong. When the borders are blurred, then you have border fights and you can have wars. When you know where your border is, you can respect the border of the other. And this is what I've come to see in these debates and in the practical work we're doing together. I try not to have too much talk, but that we go out together. Let's look at practical projects of social justice or, for example, restoring in Israel mosques which have been destroyed during the years, or working with ideas where we also challenge each other to our own interpretation. I would not want, or I have at least, I hope, enough humility to not to try to interpret Islam. It's difficult enough for me to interpret Judaism. But it's very important what kind of interpretation do we give. Because you can find everything. The Talmud already says about the Torah, the Holy Torah, it says that the Torah can be a drug for death. Now that's a very, very sharp statement. But that's if you misuse the Torah. And there are enough interpretations around to misuse, and some of them we hear also today. That it can be a drug which can bring death to people. There are, on the other side, so many important parts of the Jewish tradition which makes it what it should be, which is a tree for life. And that is my hope, that we can develop with the really hundreds of young imams and rabbis and priests who are involved in the work we're doing in Jerusalem today, that we can develop a tradition of interpretation and confidence in that when we crush the other, we're also crushing the image of God in the other. And therefore, that cannot necessarily not be the will of God.
Let's talk about two of the practical dimensions you've referred to at this conference. One is environmentalism, and the other, women and the way traditions have treated women. The symbol of the Jordan River is very interesting here. The pollution in the Jordan River, the concern about the Red Sea, is the Dead Sea rather, is becoming critical, and it's almost another critical bellwether. Here is a place to watch to see how the earth is being damaged.
Yes, I always talk to those of my colleagues who talk a lot about the land of Israel and the size of the land of Israel. I said, we should be a little less concerned with the size and a little more concerned about what we're doing with this land. Like, if we really love this land, then how do we treat it in this way that we pollute it and the air and the gases which we spread? How can we do that if we really love the land? And I think the same is true for our Palestinian and other Arab neighbors. So I think that this is a good place to start. And the truth is that religions are starting to take environmentalism seriously. There are enough sources. You see, to work against the ultra-capitalistic society, the ultra-consumer society, which really just wants us to exploit more and more what we have of resources. In order to stand against that, you need something which is very strong. There is nothing stronger than religion to stand up against this. God owns the land, not we. And God has given us this land in order that we can produce things and we can take care of it, not in order for us to destroy it. And there are so many sources in all our traditions which say this very clearly. I was just a couple of weeks ago at Windsor Castle in an environment conference with the UN Secretary General and the Royal House of England and others. But the religions were there represented, and I was very impressed there, actually. And while I feel that in Copenhagen now, most countries are going in order to say how terrible the problem is, but how little our country, my country, can get away with. How little we can do. Actually, when the religions were meeting, we were trying to say, how much can we do? How much can we contribute with? And that was, for me, a positive development. In the issue of relationship to women, I think we in religion also have a lot to deal with and a lot of repentance to do. I think that we have potentials, again, in all religions, which can turn away the disgustful, also today, relationship and misuse of women in all kinds of frameworks, the discriminations, but not only discriminations. We have sexual abuse and inside also religious communities and outside religious communities, and we can't put this under the carpet somehow, hide it away. We need to put it in the open, and every woman who is abused and discriminated against should really be the center of our care, our affection, our commitment, that this cannot happen in a world where women who are equally and naturally created in the image of God, that this can happen.
You're on Sunday Night. Our guest is Michael Melchior, Chief Rabbi of Norway, former member of the Israeli Knesset and Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs in Israel, and Chief Rabbi of the country of Norway. Michael Melchior, you've been very generous with your time. Let me talk to you about your immediate aspirations. What's the plan?
First of all, I think that we need to find a way, this is important also for the Jewish world, to work together, those who are religious and those who are not religious, those who are secular or even atheist. I believe in a kind of Judaism which can be created from a meeting place between the believer and the heretic. And I think that this is a very, very interesting meeting place, and wonderful, inspirational, and very relevant things can be created in our future. Therefore, I started building schools in Israel, all over the country, where we're studying together for the first time in history, studying together and creating a new Judaism together, which is very exciting. When it comes to relationship with our neighbors, and especially the focus of the conflict between Islam and Judaism, I very much hope that we can create a track two beyond the political process of political leaders, who I don't know if they really want to make peace, but let's say give them the credit of doubt and hope that they want to make peace. And give them the assistance, the push, not the excuse why not to make peace. And I hope that both our administration, Israel, and the Palestinians, and the Americans, who are quite important in this also, will realize the importance of this. There was a former Secretary of State, important lady called Madeleine Albright, and she wrote a book when she was finished with her period as Secretary of State, which is called The Mighty and the Almighty, which is really a kind of confession that she was mistaken in excluding religion from the process, with all the disastrous results of this. And I don't want President Obama in 4 or 8 years to write such a book. I want him to understand at this stage that we should involve the very strong forces which are positive in the religions in order to help legitimize a process, not in order to that religious leaders to take over for where political leaders should be doing their job, but to legitimize this. Since Oslo, on Israeli side, we had a person who went and killed our prime minister. And that was actually the day I decided to go into politics, 4th of November 1995. He did it because he was delegitimizing, from a religious perspective, the peace process, and demonizing the people who were identified with this process. And we have others, some of the extremists in the settler movements and others, who are using religion in order to stop the possibility of having a political process. On the other side, we've seen again and again how religious Islamist forces have blown up the process, not made it possible for any progress. I think that we need to deal with this in a serious way, to take issue with where the problem really is, because if you keep on solving the problem where that's not where the problem is, then you fail, and then people become very frustrated. Let's deal with it. It's not going to be easy, but if we really take it there, and my experience says that there are enough powers in religion who are redeeming powers, who really want a good future for our peoples. Jerusalem can be a slippery slope to hell, but it can also be a gate, and it should be, the gate to heaven. And if we can work it out in Jerusalem, there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to work it out other places in the world. And there are strong forces in Jerusalem who want this.
Michael Melchior, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. All the best.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/sundaynights with an S. Thank you for listening.